This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, I'm here with Christopher Cook, an award-winning journalist who has written about food and agriculture and the environment for many publications like the Los Angeles Times, Harper's, The Atlantic. And he's also the author of the book, Diet for a Dead Planet, Big Business and the Coming Food Crisis. Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be with you. Thank you.
And where are you calling in from? Are you in San Francisco?
I'm in San Francisco, so it's still late morning here.
Great, and probably a lot warmer than here because we're in the midst of a little bit of a freezing cold spell here in New York.
Yeah, sounds brutal.
So you write for lots of different publications. Are you writing mostly for one or a few specific ones right now? What are you working on?
Yeah, I mean, I freelance for different, mostly national publications like The Nation and sometimes Mother Jones and In These Times, which is an excellent, sometimes lesser-known publication. Also longtime contributor to The Progressive magazine. And I write a lot around food issues, food system, food politics, the environment, but also issues of labor and social justice and corporate power. And politics.
Right. We have a lot in common, and I feel probably we could talk about all these issues for a very long time, but we're going to focus on the Green New Deal today. I invited you on because you recently reported a story for Civil Eats that essentially looked at how the Green New Deal might affect food and agriculture in the U.S. I think, you know, a great place to start is, this might seem kind of basic, but there's so much going on in politics and policy right now, as we all know. It's like you can barely keep up with the craziness of every day, right? So, I almost just want you to explain, like, what is the Green New Deal, in case someone hasn't heard of it, or it's just, like, sort of buried in their newsfeed, you know?
No, absolutely. And I think it's a good question, actually, because it's not a... it's not fixed in stone, and it is a kind of a moving target or moving subject. And so the concept has been around for more than a decade. The Green Party actually is sort of the first political entity that was putting this forth in the United States. And now in the past few months, Representative Ocasio-Cortez from New York and some other legislators have been promoting this idea in Congress. And the concept is to create millions of jobs, to expand renewable energy, and address the climate crisis, and therefore decarbonize the economy, as they say. And in other words, remove, you know, there are many things we can go into, but, you know, remove carbon from the environment, sequester carbon in various ways, and then at the same time, radically reduce carbon production by eliminating as much fossil fuel use as possible and production as possible, and moving basically everything in our economy to something that is actually more sustainable and that isn't going to completely destroy at least human life as we know it.
Right. So there's obviously a lot involved in all this. Like you said, it's kind of this transformational thing, and that is across lots of sectors of the economy. I think probably the biggest, you know, when you talk about climate, we talk about energy, transportation. But, you know, obviously this is a show about food and agriculture. So my first question is just how much of it talks about food and agriculture?
Yeah. No, and this is actually really important. Very little. In the conversation about the Green New Deal in the past, say, 6 months or 4 months, whatever, the food and agriculture aspect hasn't really been talked about much at all. A handful of articles, mine and some others out there, some political advocacy groups around the country, in the food and farming sector are really starting to raise this issue. So within the resolution, which is in Congress now, which isn't legislation, if you should remember, it's just a resolution to set maybe a framework and some concepts and get some support and buy-in. There is one very, very short section or a couple of paragraphs about food and agriculture. And at least, you know, I feel like they said some good things about supporting local and sustainable agriculture and investing in those kinds of things. And, you know, that's great. And supporting smaller scale family farms, you know, those are all good things. Not nearly enough. I mean, I think that it's important for folks to know that the food and agriculture sector is the single biggest contributor to climate change out of every sector, energy, transportation, worldwide, the food and agriculture production sector is the top contributor, contributes anywhere from 25 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And that's, you know, that's everything from fossil fuel-based pesticides and chemicals to large-scale machinery and all the dust that's kicked up from that. And that's also from the methane, phenomenal amounts of methane and hydrogen sulfide that come out of giant animal factory farms and long-distance transportation of food. So there's many deforestation, removing forests, which store carbon in order to have more sprawling factory farms and other types of commodity farms. So these things are all part of a system that absolutely... It's not about wanting it to change. It absolutely has to change for our future to be there.
to exist. but so, I mean, if it's the single biggest contributor to climate change, why is it only getting this one short section?
Yeah, I don't have a clear, easy answer for that. I mean, I think that as long as climate change has been talked about, food and agriculture has sort of struggled to get its part in the conversation. And I think that that is not unique to the Green New Deal. I think that climate action movements and others, you know, have started to really recognize this much more in recent years, but it's taken a lot of pushing. I think that it doesn't necessarily automatically make sense, you know, that farming would be such a huge producer of greenhouse gases. I think that, you know, you look at huge power plants and jet planes and semi trucks and other things like that, and the grid, you know, very sustainable grid and gazillions of cars and trucks, those are much more obvious emitters than a farm, which, you know, we think of as this beautiful, you know, green, there's...
You think of it as sort of part of nature, not as...
So that might be part of it. But of course, you know, so much of our food is transported in those toxic, unsustainable ways. So that's just one piece of the food climate, you know, food print, as many of us are saying now. But, you know, is you know, whether it's air transport, shipping in various ways, semi trucks, rail, you know, all those things are part of food's imprint on the environment because of our food system, which is not very local or regionally oriented, and which, you know, we can talk more about this if you want, but, you know, it's based so much, especially in the U.S., but in other areas as well, on producing large-scale, you know, commodities, which then get processed into other foods and therefore get shipped and processed all over the place, adding to that climate footprint instead of more local and regional foods that are, you know, diverse and ready to eat.
Yeah. So do you see like local and regional foods as one of the biggest kind of solutions that is available in terms of changing the food system to be more, to have a smaller footprint or smaller environmental impact?
I see it as a key part. I think that, you know, we can't reduce the solution to one element or another. But I think that absolutely we have to, you know, scale is one piece. I'm not one to sort of emphasize that scale is everything, because I think that our economy, capitalist, you know, system is fundamentally part of what we're dealing with here that we have to look at, mm-hmm. not just size. But I do think that when you look at the food system, if you look at farmers who are trapped in GMOs and pesticides and get big or get out, which is this concept that's been around for decades in the food policy, you know, idea that, you know, either you own more and more land and farm more and more acres of a single commodity like corn or wheat or soy, or you just get out.
Right.
And so what we are seeing is 12,000 farmers a year going out of business. And some of that is really because of this idea that you have to get big or get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's critical that, you know, we both, you know, we create incentives for local and regional food production, but not just that, you know, also organic and regenerative farming practices and diversified food production. Mm-hmm. Is the other key, another big key. And there are many other like farming practices that have to do with soil that we could talk about. But I think the basic idea about local and regional production is to not say, well, everything must be within 5 or 10 miles or I'm not going to eat it, because it's just not realistic.
Right.
For so many places and for many people. But I think the idea is that, you know, if we simultaneously can encourage farmers to diversify food production, produce an array of crops for local and regional markets, shift to organic. You know, these are all things that many farmers would like to do,
mm-hmm.
but they're not given the ability to do it. They're not given the time and the resources and support to do it.
Right. So in your reporting on the Green New Deal, does the plan outline ways to help farmers do that? Like, can you give us a sense of what they suggest might be a policy approach to helping farmers make those changes?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not in there right now. There's just sort of a nod, you know, a decent nod to some of these concepts. But and you know, we don't know whether that's purposeful. Maybe they didn't want to be boxed in. You know, I don't know inside the brain trust
right.
how that decision was made. But I do know that there are coalitions and groups around the country that are really starting to put forward ideas. There was a group of agroecology experts and professors about a few weeks or a month ago who put out a really interesting letter, group letter, and I know there are other elements of this that are in the works to really emphasize that Congress take on some of these policies around. So, for instance, have some type of public investments or supports for organic farming and transitioning to organic farming.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give people, farmers, you know, some form of support, whether you call it a subsidy or a support of some other kind, or, you know, an investment to transition to organic production and diversified production of multiple different types of crops,
mm-hmm.
And also provide funding mechanisms to expand local and regional markets for those crops. So whether it's farmers markets or you know, getting away from the giant Walmarts of the world and having, which really, you know, do some damage, even though they do sell organics, but they do some damage by, you know, really basically giving farmers and producers no leverage in the marketplace,
right.
No ability to negotiate a fair price for their products is the least of what they do.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, these kinds of, you know, whether you call it incentives or investments or supports for organic, smaller scale, diversified production will be key. People are also talking about any form of subsidy or support that farmers get needs to also require that there be a set of sustainable practices that are either followed or put in place, you know, whether it's, you know, protecting pollinators, right. And pollinator habitats, or
like something like cover crops, maybe.
Yeah. Excuse me?
Something like cover crops, maybe. Like
cover crops, yeah. Exactly. And less tillage of the soil, not necessarily no-till, but less till of the soil. And, you know, good crop rotation practices, and like you're saying, and so those, and again, moving away from toxic pesticides and chemical fertilizers will be key as well. And, you know, it's important for people to know that, you know, right now we spend $13 to $15 billion a year in subsidies and crop insurance that goes almost entirely to large scale commodity producers of like in the corn, soy, wheat, and a few other key crops that are primarily used as either animal feed or fuel stocks or for processed foods. And you know, again, a lot of the problem with this is that it's almost entirely GMO produced and pesticide based. Mm-hmm. And so we absolutely have to shift those dollars in a different direction if we're going to have a hope at reducing emissions and also sequestering carbon, you know, improving the quality of soil, giving our farmland soils the ability to store carbon as well as grow healthier food and actually use less water.
Right. So we have to take a quick break, but we're going to be back in a minute and we'll keep talking about the Green New Deal. And I want to sort of get into where this is all headed and what we can really expect to happen. So we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. It's Todd Shulkin, the host of Inside Julia's Kitchen here on HRN. Inside Julia's Kitchen carries on Julia Child's legacy of introducing the brightest lights in the food world to a wider audience, just as Julia did from her home kitchen. Look for Inside Julia's Kitchen wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
We're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Chris Cook. We've been talking about the Green New Deal and how it might impact food and agriculture. So, Chris, before the break, we were talking a lot about different aspects of the policy and just also different ways that food and agriculture systems need to shift in order to address climate change. I'm curious... I want to talk a little bit about like what's really going to happen? Like what, you know, and obviously neither of us really know, you know, neither of us unfortunately know a lot about that at this point. But, I think, well, one thing you said earlier really interested me, which is that like, this has been a plan that's been in the works for a long time, from the Green Party. And it kind of like, you know, I didn't know that. I hadn't heard of it. And so it's gotten this renewed, push and interest because a major political party is now, going to bat for it. Right. The Democrats, or at least a few of them. But so, you know, it's a House resolution. What does that mean? Like what comes next? What's the pathway for it to actually morph into something that would be voted on and become law?
Yeah. This is by far the less fun part.
Right.
And, you know, not to be too much in the pun world, but you know, where the sausage is made.
Right.
So, all right, no more of that. But anyway, so there's a resolution in the House, sponsored by Ocasio-Cortez and actually, co-sponsored by, my last count was 67 members of Congress. It's probably higher than that now.
Okay.
And then in the Senate, Senator Markey from Massachusetts, has a similar resolution there. Senator Merkley from Oregon is, talking about putting forth legislation or a resolution, so we'll see what that looks like, or if it dovetails with this. So it would be non-binding. It wouldn't be legislation, but it would be a step forward. And from the beginning, what I was hearing from the Sunrise Movement and from Ocasio-Cortez when they were starting to push this idea was that it's really about getting something ready to go by 2020. And if you don't start now, you won't have it ready by then. I think everybody recognizes that nothing like this is going to pass the Republican Senate.
Right.
It's hard enough to even get broader support in the Democratic Party, frankly, and the leadership, which I've written a bit about that, and it's quite maddening given that they know how dire the climate crisis is. But I wrote a piece for In These Times, which folks can look up, about Nancy Pelosi and other Democratic leaders stifling the Green New Deal by crushing the select committee idea. The original idea was to create a select committee to focus entirely on creating a Green New Deal and having hearings and create legislation that would be ready to go by 2020 if we had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. And so instead, they basically crushed that movement and recreated a climate committee, climate and energy committee from 2007 that has no legislative authority, no ability to create legislation. So, and they're still generally dismissing, when I say they, I mean some of the House leadership, like Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and the others. It sounds like they're softening their opposition a little bit, maybe, but they're not supporting it, which is utterly remarkable. I don't know. You know, I understand they're afraid of being called socialists, but they're going to be called socialists no matter what they do anyway.
Right.
So I think that, you know, what's promising is that this has gotten as far as it's gotten, for all the frustrations that folks might have, that this has gotten to the point where there is a resolution in Congress that's got, you know, I think close to 70 co-sponsors now, and has at least, you know, perhaps a chance of passing, I don't know, as a resolution. I don't know what the vote count would look like right now, frankly. And I wouldn't hold my breath to see it pass. But the ideas have been put forward very strongly. And I think that it's made, you know, it's made climate change a really major part of the conversation. The problem, of course, is that that's not nearly enough. I mean, we've been knowing about this and having these conversations for decades, and the climate crisis is only getting worse and more dire to the point where scientists around the world, you know, have concluded that we have 12 to 15 years to have any hope of reversing, or not even reversing, but really slowing this passive destruction and giving ourselves any chance of reversing it in the future. We're pretty much headed toward a longer period of irreversible, temporarily irreversible climate catastrophe for now. But I think a lot of the idea is you can slow this down and put humanity and the planet in a better position.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. It's... I mean, and meanwhile, it's like, you know, we're talking about this, what's going on in the government and they're them trying to squash it with these committees. And meanwhile, yeah. There's also, Republican representatives telling the American people that Ocasio-Cortez wants to take away their burgers. Because, you know, she made a comment that, one of the small things we need to do to, you know, save the planet from these dire consequences is maybe not all eat meat 3 times a day. And, you know, she even qualified it with, I don't mean everyone should go vegan. Like, this is not, And it's like a comment that seems to me to be just so uncontroversial. Like, you know, we sort of know at this point that the science shows we need to all cut back. Like the planet needs to cut back on meat, meat production, and especially the ways that we produce it now. And that's, it's like, it's still effective for people in policy to kind of use that as a talking point and say like, and people are like responding to that. Like, no, I don't want, I want my burger. It's like, well, you're not gonna be able to eat a burger if the world is like,
exactly.
So, I mean, it's just, it's so, it can be a little maddening, I guess. In your reporting, like, have you come across things that, like, ways that you communicate about food and climate that you think are more effective that people respond to?
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard to say. Some folks are just not going to respond to anything, and they're only going to hear the other side and the fear mongering and fear tactics. You know, I do point to studies that have shown that if you reduce, not even eliminate, but just reduce meat consumption, like in school lunch programs in Oakland, they did a whole study about this, and the kids were completely fine. They were, well, maybe not all of them, but, you know, anyway, they were, you know,
generally,
all the surveys, all the response showed they were happy with the lunches. The health content was at least as strong as it was before. The school district saved money, they saved water, and they significantly reduced their greenhouse gas emissions or their footprint, not, you know, direct emissions, but their associated emissions by purchasing less meat. I think, again, the key is, the other side is going to call you a radical socialist no matter what you say.
Yeah.
but I think that, you know, again, this is reality. This is human reality, and I think that more people get it than don't get it. And, you know, whether it's eliminating one's meat consumption or radically reducing one's meat consumption, and also, you know, about improving it. So for those who feel that there's no way they're going to get, you know, stop eating meat, you know, eating less and better quality meat that is organic and grass-fed or free-range, local or regionally produced, yes, it does cost more. I think we need to do something about that through public supports, perhaps, to encourage more of that. Not more meat production, but more of that part of the meat sector.
Right.
Just being realistic, we're not going to just eliminate all this. And understanding that people have their budgets and they're not going to spend more than X amount of dollars, but, you know, could people be persuaded, you know, well, this is better for your health. You can still eat meat. Mm. You know, and I think the key is this is about our future. I mean, this is about, you know, if you have kids, grandkids, thinking about having kids, whatever it is, or you just happen to care about people other than yourself and your friends, but future generations.
Yeah.
That's what this is about, you know, and I think that it's, you know, I understand that people have this issue about sort of, you know, quote, the nanny state, you know, or pointing the finger and saying, you know, you can only eat X amount, this many ounces of meat. You know, nobody's saying that. really, and nobody in power is saying that, and they don't even have the power to really do that.
Yeah.
They wouldn't get that through anyway, so there's no worry there.
Right.
But it is about saying we have choices to make. You know, these are objective, scientifically shown. These are choices that we have to make, and we all make these in our individual lives, and we set priorities, and we don't get everything we want constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I hate to sound like some sort of parent on this, but I do feel like the Republican messaging is infantilizing.
Yeah.
And it really does create this idea that, you know, that Americans, you know, are just, all we want is our cake and eat it too. We want our ice cream and we want our, and we don't want anything else. And, you know, as much as there might be fear of losing some of that, I don't think that's the case. I think that when you drill down, people understand their choices, their priorities, and it's hard for people to picture that with climate change because most people are not seeing it or necessarily experiencing it or understanding it in their direct, you know, immediate lives. But you look at the people who are. I mean, farmers around the country are suffering hugely mm-hmm. from the climate crisis, and that affects everything from their own survival to their communities to food prices. Even food corporations now put in their bottom line and in their risk reports, they talk about climate change as a huge risk factor. So there's great awareness about this, and I think that the challenge is not just convincing people that climate change is real and it's here and it's now, but showing how that's the case. And, you know, that can sometimes be tricky because, climate change may not have created the forest fire, but it created the wind tunnels and the extent of the forest fire by the weather patterns and the wind and the, wind patterns that basically exacerbated.
Right.
You know, the same thing with the size and the scope and the frequency of hurricanes, the seasonal shifts that don't make headlines that affect crop production, for instance, you know, those kinds of things, not just in the U.S., actually more dramatically in other parts of the world even. So all these things, you know, I think that it's just going to continue to take work to show people the really remarkable levels of suffering and cost, financial and human costs that are going on in the U.S. and around the world due to climate change. And you're always, unfortunately, going to have the deniers. And I think in every aspect of politics, this is what we're dealing with. You know, we're dealing with resistance even within the Democratic Party due to perhaps a set of, like, electoral concerns, but also, frankly, the fossil fuel industry and the money that they provide. And the fact that the Democratic Party reversed itself on banning fossil fuel money in campaigns.
Right.
That all plays a role. And then on the other side of things, you've got denialism and how convenient that is to prop up some of those same interests. So it's just about continuing to try to educate and have these conversations and make people aware. People are suffering now.
Yeah, yeah.
Climate crisis.
And yeah, they are suffering. And this, all this can feel, I think, it can feel really sort of bleak and overwhelming. I'm curious, we have to wrap up and I want to sort of ask you this question, I think, as a final point. I'm curious if, you know, you do this kind of reporting all the time. Are you optimistic at all that this new policy push will be effective in sort of reducing the impact of food production on climate change?
I don't know about this particular resolution or legislation at the moment. I have to say, politically, I'm not sure that I'm super optimistic. But what I am optimistic about is that the ideas and the evidence are getting pushed forward more and more centrally in the conversation. I think you'll see that in the coming weeks and months, that there's going to be more and more nationwide conversation about climate change and the vital importance and urgency of some form of a Green New Deal and the huge importance of the food and agriculture sector and the need to transform it, not again because people want to transform it, but because we have to. And I guess what's optimistic to me, to some extent, is the knowledge is there, the models for doing this are there. There's no reason we can't do it if we get the political will and the money behind it to shift the priorities. We already have phenomenal amounts of money pushing us in this deadly direction that we're in right now. And I talk about this extensively in my book, Diet for a Dead Planet, if people want to learn more about the history behind all this and the money and the power behind all this. But we can shift, you know, shift those resources. And if we don't win nationally, you know, these can become ideas that can continue to be put forth on state and local levels as they already are. So that's hopeful as well.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you, Chris, so much for being here and for all of your insights. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. And just before we go, if people want to follow your work online, where can they find you?
Yeah, thank you. So they can go to my website, which is www.christopherdcook.com. So it's www.christopherdcook.com. And my book, again, is Diet for a Dead Planet. It's been out for a while, but it's still sadly relevant and fairly timely, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, and then articles in Civil Eats and The Nation and In These Times and places like that.
Great. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. I'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.